My name is Paul Price, and I'm honored once again to chat with Mr. Richard Masser for the Actors Fund on Monday, November 14th, 2016, at the Actors Fund in New York City, New York. Oral History 3 of 3. How are you, sir?
All right. As well as can be expected, given what just happened 6 days ago.
Yes, indeed. We've been dealing with a lot since the elections. Speaking of which, and we talked the last time we met about your political life and your activism. I want to ask you, seeing change, and you've experienced and seen a number of changes in the industry over the years. What do you feel, or how do you feel about growing older in this profession?
I feel extraordinarily fortunate, I have to tell you. I'm very lucky, all of us who are of a certain age are very lucky that we caught what I think will be the tail end of a sort of, or not the tail end, but the late middle and the tail end of what was an expansive process in the industry from this point of view. When I came in to the business, I worked with people who were still under contract to the studio. So the studio contract process was still in place. And what that meant was they would find young, mostly young people that they thought had promise. All the studios did this for many years. And like I said, when I was coming in the early 70s, it was mostly done. But Universal, for example, still had a very active contract program. They would find people, they would put them under contract, and putting them under contract meant that they would have a weekly salary, which was extraordinary for an actor, and the guaranteed salary meant you were making a decent living. Not great, but a decent living. But for that contract payment, they could then use you in as many jobs as they wanted to. You didn't get paid outside of the contract price. And they could even put you into a series, and you were not making the kind of series money that anybody else was. And those contracts were 7 years long. And let me digress for a second to tell you why. This is actually a great story. I heard this from Robert Preston on my first big movie. He told me about this. Preston had been a very young man, like 20 years old, when he was spotted at the Pasadena Playhouse and brought into screen test for a movie called 20th Century. And it was starring opposite Barbara Stanwyck, a young Barbara Stanwyck, who was already starting to be a star. And so he did quite well because he was 20. He signed his own contract with the studio, but it was invalid because he was 20. They didn't realize he was underage. He had to be 21 to have a valid contract. So after a year or two, his agent discovered that the contract was signed when he was still a minor, and they went back, renegotiated his contract, and he was already in a couple of big movies, and he made much, much more money than mostly anyone else on the contract was making, because they didn't have the leverage. He had the leverage. Anyway, World War II came along. A lot of guys left, went off to the war. He was one of them. When they came back, everything had changed, because these contracts that you signed were open-ended. There were one-way options. The studio had the option to renew your contract or to keep it in place. If you wanted to get out of it, you had to get the next studio to buy your studio out of your contract, which very often made a lot of money for the studio you were assigned to and put a lot of pressure on you with the new studio. But you had no control over it. So what happened was, during the war, a woman named Olivia de Havilland, who was a great actress and a really smart woman, who had by then been nominated and won two Academy Awards, she went into her studio, and I think it was MGM, and she said to Louis B. Mayer, I want to renegotiate my contract, or I want to break my contract. And he said, no, absolutely not. She said, no, but you see, you can't hold me to it. And he said, what are you talking about? She said, I've been with you for 7 years, and under British common law, which pertains in this country, under British common law, and therefore under U.S. law, a personal service contract of in excess of 7 years is considered slavery. Mm-hmm. Because back in the day, when people would sign up to be for indentured servitude, mm-hmm. okay, they would bind themselves to an employer, and those contracts could not exceed 7 years. Well, she won her case, and every single contract of every single actor in the business that was longer than 7 years old was abrogated. All these guys come back from the war, and most of them had overstayed their 7 year contract at that point. And Preston was one of the first people to find out about this, and he marched into Fox, and or was it Columbia? I forget. But he marched into his studio, and he said, "So what are we doing?" They said, "What do you mean you're coming back?" And he said, "Well, I'm not sure. What are you going to offer me?" They said, "No, Press." He says, "Well, my contract's up. You know, the Havilland decision." And they said, "Yeah, but you were away in the war." I said, "Nothing about that. Doesn't say anything about that in the law." And they had to renegotiate with him, and he was one of the highest paid people in the business. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's how we ended up with 7 year contracts. So all these contracts at the studios were 7 year contracts, and it was only in the late 70s, very late 70s, when they finally shut down the studio system at Universal, and that was the last time. So that's what was in place when I started. Mm. But when I said we were here at this very lucky moment, so that was part of the lucky moment. It was all freelance from then on, which meant that we were all free agents. We could move around more freely, though the networks tried to come up with a version of that, which is they would put you under a holding deal to try and develop material for you, which would tie you up for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cycles of pilot seasons. And that was another way they had of controlling. When you signed for a series, then every series contract was for 7 years. Then it went to like 5 years because people started objecting. And then it slowly crept back up, and now it's, I think, 5.5, 6 years. So all of that was in flux. The three networks were about to become four networks because in the 80s, there was the show called Fame, which was a terrific show. A terrific film, I should say, that they made into a series. And the series was very expensive to produce and wasn't really knocking it out of the park for the network. So it was canceled. I think it was NBC. But the studio, which happened to be Fox, really loved the property. So they said, let's see if we can go out and sell the... I think it had two seasons before they canceled it. Let's see if we can go out and sell the two seasons and tell them we're going to produce more and sell them directly to the syndicators, to the independent stations. And they started doing that. And that's how the Fox network started, was with this direct syndication packaging that Fox invented, frankly. And then they did another original show, and it was called Married with Children. and it was a huge hit. And they started doing the same thing. They started going around and selling this, and stations were coming in like crazy. And then Fox started requiring that if they were going to carry those two, they also had to carry these other shows they were taking, making. And slowly, over not that many years, actually, over a few years, they put together what was a very big syndicate. But they kept it just under the number of stations that would have defined them under the law as a television network, because with that, they would have had to fall under a whole bunch of other regulations, including, you know, under the Screen Actors Guild contracts, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, we all had different rules for syndicated programming and for network programming, and the pay scales and the residual formula were much higher for networks. And Fox managed to stay under it for way longer than they should have, simply by refusing to take on that one extra station, which would have put them over the top. So everything was changing, how things were delivered. Then once Fox became officially, not even officially a network, but this huge syndicator, well, Warner's and Paramount and Universal combined, they formed this thing called UPN. Warner started the WB, and there were these, what we came to be known as the mini nets, and production just exploded, because there was all this production for all these outlets which hadn't existed 5 years before. You know, it was three networks, and local programming had nothing to do with the stuff that we were doing, you know, with the primetime network style program. So that really changed the primetime business, and it's been changing ever since. I don't know if that's responsive to that.
But for you, how do you feel, what has been the biggest challenge and also the biggest upside now, especially now with this explosion in television?
Right, I lost track of what you would ask me. So what was great when I came in was if you got into that network world, you were making very solid money, even as a guest star. But if you got onto regular television series, it was extremely good money. And from extremely good money to ridiculously good money. And then, similarly, stuff started happening in feature films, and this had to do with the corporatization of all of this stuff too, I think, especially the film business. But also the television business, because much of television was made by companies owned by the same people, the same entities that owned the feature film part of the business. So what started happening was, for the first time, I remember the first time I ever heard of a movie star being paid $1 million for a movie. It was like, it was unbelievable. At that time, this is in the 70s, mid-70s. At that time, a big movie, a big feature film cost $10 million, $11 million. So to pay one person, you know, 10% of what the entire film was going to cost, that was insanity. But part of what drove that was also the shift in how movies were marketed, because they were being marketed domestically. That was what you based your entire business model on. And then when they sold to international buyers, that was gravy. But now everything was starting to change a little bit, where the international buyers were becoming not as important as the domestic market, but it was starting to grow in a really strong way. And with that, the decisions about who the top one or two people in each film would be and what they would be paid started being made not because of the casting process, not really because of the artistic choice making. Yeah. It's those decisions started being made based on how much money could be raised in different markets to offset the cost of the film based on who was in one of those two or three top positions. So, and it comes into play because a lot of people, as this started happening more and more, and people were making $1 million, and then there was this whole arms race about who could make more, and a few actors were competing to be, you know, and like Burt Reynolds, who was the first person I ever knew personally who broke $1 million, he might have been the first person who broke $1 million. He and then others were playing leapfrog to see who could. So then somebody broke $5 million, and then somebody broke $10 million, and because of this, film budgets started going crazy. And it wasn't just that, it was also the expectations of people when they went to the movies, because the prices of film of theater tickets were going up, not exactly at the same rate, but very quickly, because the cost of the films were going up so much. So all of this was running in parallel, and that changed the entire decision-making process. What films do we choose? So now we're at a point where the only films that get made into features at this point, or the vast majority of them, have to do with unbelievably complicated special effects and amazing imagery and something that really says to the audience, you cannot experience this unless you come to the theater. Because if we're going to make a feature film, you need to come to the theater, because we need to make that money before you start making other money, number one. Number two, in the days, and now we live in the days of perfect reproduction. See, when I started in the 70s, I think I mentioned this to you before in an earlier session, if you could make a copy of something that you saw on television with a thing called a video cassette, it was a very, very creaky facsimile of what was actually being broadcast. And then if you made a copy of that, it was like not good. And then a copy of that was just useless. So like three generations and it was garbage. Now, every copy of every copy of every copy of every copy ad infinitum are the identical ones and zeros. There's no difference. Assuming that the original thing that you were copying from in each iteration were done correctly and on a good medium, there's no difference. They're identical. So what happens is you have a picture opens today, and the minute something exists in digital form, someone will steal it and start distributing it on the internet, start distributing it on DVDs, and your ability to create a really viable box office at the theater just drops off to nothing. So now the only thing for which the business model holds up is you got to come to the theater to see this, or because if you don't, you will never. That's why the rebirth of 3D happened. You know, you're going to get completely immersed in the experience. They tried to do that in the 50s. It was like ridiculous. You know, I mean, it was so stupid. It was these green images and red images that were kind of vaguely working in your brain, but not. I went to see, it's the only 3D film I've seen since I was a child. I went to see Gravity and I sat there in the theater giggling to myself. I went, look at this. This is real. They actually did it. There's something floating right at my head. I know it's going to hit me. It was crazy. And that was already, 4 or 5 years ago. I'm sure it's 10 times better now. So because this, you know, I forget whose law it is, but somebody's law says that the amount of storage and computing capacity doubles or triples every 2 months or whatever. So it's just, it just gets better and better and better and better. Having said all that, so the cost of film became so expensive that the decision-making process changed. In television, television became the recipient of the geniuses, and I use the term advisedly, who 25 years earlier would never have thought to go to television to write. They would have been writing features, they would have been writing plays, but instead TV, thanks to HBO initially, Showtime, then AMC, and then Stars and the others, and then ultimately Netflix and Amazon. They basically say, you are these fabulous talents, you have a wonderful idea, come and make it. We'll stay out of your way. And they do. This was the genius of, I think, both HBO and Showtime. They hired people who were really, really good, almost all from the feature world. And they said, come make a story that you can't make out there. Make it here, you know, a mini series, an ongoing series. Be as creative as you want to be. We don't want to get in your way. We will have some budgetary considerations, which we'll try and manage, but come make your thing here. And that has created an explosion of possibility. What's also happened in the process, and this is, I'm finally getting to your answer now, is that the financial rewards for the performers have changed dramatically. When I came into the business, originally, when even before I got here, television, they made 39 weeks of television every year and 13 weeks of reruns. That was the summer rerun period. So they'd have reruns or they'd have goofy shows that nobody cared about because nobody watched TV in the summer. They were all out doing other more interesting stuff. And then as time went along and the recording capabilities became better, they said, well, you know, we could probably make like 26 shows a year and rerun for at least half the, if it's a good show, if it's a hit show, we just play the 26 weeks, for the bottom half of the year, and then we could start into the next year. So there were 26-week cycles. That's where I came in. So you got hired for a show, you were doing 26 weeks. That was extraordinary. Then that went to 22. Then it started going, well, we might do fewer. And when you were originally, when I started, the first pickup was 13 shows. So you made a pilot and they'd pick you up for 12 shows. That was the minimum. And then by the mid 80s, they were doing what were called short orders and they'd pick you up for 8 shows or 6 shows. They wanted to see how the series was not only forming as you were making it, but also what it was looking like. And by this point, there was much more corporate interference in the creative process than there had been when I started. But with all of that having been said, the ability to make a living doing 8 guest shots a year and the residuals from the reruns, assuming they were all network shows, which mostly were all network shows, you could do that. You could put together a career doing that. And 8 guest shots in a year, that's a lot. You got to be doing pretty well to do that, but it's doable for a fair number of people. If you got a series, that's definitely going to be a living. And it would be a living that would continue because of the residuals. What's happened, what we've had to do during the course of the last 4.5 decades is we've had to adjust how we try and capture the value that needs to be shared with the creative people. We've had to adjust because originally it was based on a fixed formula. Okay, you want to use this, it's going to cost you X number of dollars or X percentage of what the original fee was. And then the people making the product would factor those numbers into their bottom line. Then when and the same was true in syndication, and the numbers were lower because the income was lower. But all of this, all of the income flow, all of the cash flow happens in the dark in this business. It's very hard to ferret it out. So then when some, you know, different things like the HBO programming, the pay cable program, that formula didn't work. It didn't make any sense there because they're not getting paid advertising dollars. It's based on subscriber fees and how do you monetize what the individual thing is worth. It's weird. So we started linking into what's called revenue-based formulas. And it, I mean, it actually started before that in the sales into supplement what are called supplemental markets like video cassette and then cable runs of features and stuff like that. These are all revenue based formulas, which is to say we get a certain percentage of what the producer is getting for the use of the product, and then that's distributed to us in a lump. And then is distributed to the cast according to different formula. Those all actually have been working for the last 25, 30 years, and they've been working well. They're relatively small percentages, but they generate quite decent income for people. What's shifted now is cable, what's called basic cable, which is not the premium cable cable is like TNT, USA, AMC, those, all of whom are making original product, Lifetime, okay? And they're, the formula for network and for syndication didn't work for them. So we went to a revenue-based formula there. But the revenues are very, very small. And so the residuals are very, very small. So the residual base started decreasing. So it started becoming more of a volume business. 8 guest star shots were not going to do it for you. You had to get like 15 or 20 in a year. That's a lot. And even a series regular thing, if you're on a series that's on one of these outlets, unless you're really, really lucky, you're probably not making a terrific living. You're making a decent living, but it's not like it was. So when I started this, I said, and you said, what's it like to be, I'm so glad that I'm not trying to get going right now, number one. Number two, and this is the more important thing, I don't understand clearly how this modern, I sound so old, but I don't understand how this works anymore because, I mean, I hear stories from, especially from younger actors, but even from older actors, about, you know, they want to know how many Twitter followers you have. They want to know, you know, you have to be doing this stuff. I've never done it. I'm not going to. And if that means I don't work, I don't work. You know, I can't do it. You know, it's anathema to me. It has nothing to do with what I've been doing for all these years. It doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, there are millions of people who know who I am. They don't know my name in a lot of cases, but they know who I am. And they've known who I was for 40 plus years. I can't suddenly start like, you know, I never had a publicist, I mean, in all these years. That made no sense to me. So this certainly makes no sense to me. And the way, I don't know how to describe it to you, but, well, this is the best example I can give you. When I started, you went in for an audition, and the director and the producer would be sitting in the room because they'd be looking at you to decide whether or not they wanted to hire you. Then maybe, I'm going to say, in the early to mid-80s, I would show up in an audition, and there'd be a camera there. And I would go, what's that for? They would go, oh, no, really, don't worry. I go, no. I don't do recorded auditions. If you want to do an audition, great. If you want to record me, that's a test. That's a different thing. Because that's how I grew up. And I was able to do that for a while. And then one day, my agent, I said, they said they're going to put you on tape. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And she said, you're not going to audition anymore if you're not going to do it. Now, I'd say, look, is the director going to be in the room? Yes. Okay. If the director's going to be in the room, I don't mind if I go on tape. If this is for him to look back, or her to look back. Well, there were no hers then. But if this is for him to look back and review, okay, fine. I can get my brain around that. But then it started being like there are directors who never sit in the room with anybody. They just want to record people. You can't get any feedback from them. You can't get any sense of, is this working? Am I doing it right? But also you can't adjust what you're doing. You can't say, do you need something different? You know, and get feedback. You can't, except from a casting director who, bless their hearts, some of them are great, but some of them don't know what the hell they're doing. And sometimes it's not even the casting director. It's somebody running a camera who's an assistant, and there's no feedback to be got. So that started happening more and more, and I just started feeling like, wow, this is crazy. But again, I'm going to digress and go backwards. Because of how I came into this business, which is, you know, Norman Lear saw me in a show, he put me in an episode, he hired me for my first series, I got hired for a show over at MTM for the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then that led to another show called Rhoda, which I did a recurring character on, and I did another series for Norman, and so I'm rolling along here, right? And then I start doing some TV movies, but I'm already a known person, and so they call me up, and they call my agent up, and they offer me stuff. And the vast majority of the work I got, except for features, it was offers. Even I got serious jobs on offers. I didn't, the first time I had to, in quotes, go to network on a show, I didn't know what they were talking about. I said, what do you mean? Oh, we're going to go, and we're going to, and the first time I did it was on a show called Empire, which was a wonderful show that just, it didn't find an audience, but it was really deeply funny. It was written by the two guys who wrote a film called Start the Revolution Without Me, and if you've never seen it, run and see this, Start the Revolution Without Me. It's Gene Wilder and Donald Sutherland, and it's piss your pants funny. It's just crazy funny. They play Corsican brothers, you know, four twins that one of each got hooked together, and one went to the poor people and one went to the rich people. One mismatched set, and they find each other. It's hysterically funny. Anyway, and these two guys, whose names I'm blanking on right now, but anyway, they were doing this series, and they brought me in. I read for them, which I didn't mind doing. Though they really wanted me to do it, it was clear. They said, that, look, this is pro forma. So I read for them, and then they said, the word came back that we had to go and read for network. And I said, what does that mean? Because it never happened to me before on a series. It's like the people wanted me. The network said, okay, great. And they said it's pro forma. The head of the network, or the head of programming, this guy named Fred Silverman, he wanted and who I knew, it was a gesture. I said, okay, so we went, we sat in a room, we read a scene, I finished, we shook hands, he asked me how I was, blah, 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 I left, you know, I got the part. But that, I knew that was the beginning of the end, because if I had to do that, this was all going to start getting crazy. And but the wheels didn't come off for me at all until I moved back to New York. And when I moved from LA back to New York, all of a sudden, New York rules is everybody reads for everything pretty much, and everybody goes on tape. Well, by then we're going on tape everywhere, but everybody goes on tape, and you're not getting cast unless you do this. Oh, and you're never going to see the director or the producer if you're auditioning in New York, unless it's a New York film. Because when I first came back here, there wasn't that much television going. So it was very, very debilitating. And I basically said, you know what, I don't care, forget it, I can't do this. I spent my life building a career, I spent my life creating a reputation, amassing a body of work. And I walk into a room and I'm reading for nothing. And I mean, for things that I'm not all that interested in. I said, so here's the deal. I'm only going in if I really care about this. I don't want to be that guy, and I'm just going to try and work in the theater, which I hadn't done a lot of time. And I'm going to try and get voiceovers, and I'm going to try and shift gears into being more of a New York actor. And it went like that, and I didn't do film and television I came back here in 2001. I really didn't do much of any film or television until pretty much, I'm going to say 2010, 11, mostly just doing theater. And then all of a sudden, things started happening, and they were offers, and I cannot explain it. I passed, and it's so interesting, I have to say this. I've gone through several transitions during the time I've been an actor. You know, I started out, I was in my early 20s, or mid-20s when I started working professionally. And I was very lucky. Things just popped. And I was never a juvenile. You know, I didn't have that look. I was always playing sort of slightly odd guys. And I had, and I seem to have somehow put together the chops to be able to pull some stuff off. So I was doing okay. And it was also my particular way of being seemed to fit the tone of what was happening then. This is in a broad range of stuff. I mean, it wasn't just the comedy stuff on TV. It was a lot of different kinds of things. And then I kind of worked right the way through into my 30s, and now I'm like kind of young dads, and that seemed to work really well. And I'm playing various professionals, that seemed to work pretty well, and I'm just going along, and I kept saying, I know there's going to come a point where I'm going to hit this fallow period where I'm not old yet. People don't see me as an older guy, because I always looked younger than I was, but that I'm not really the other guy anymore. And I think that's kind of what I went through, but it was combined with having moved back to New York and having not been, frankly, there was a lot of work I could have done in Los Angeles if I had been there. But part of what changed was they wanted you in the room. The days of just everybody getting offered everything, for me at least, and maybe for my cadre, my age range, those days were over. If you picture a triangle with the fat part sitting on the ground, okay, that represents the roles that are available. And at the bottom of that, draw a line and put 22. And at the top of that, put 100. Okay, so in that age range, as you go up there, those things narrow and narrow and narrow and narrow. And the older you get, the fewer the roles there are. Now, take another triangle and stand it on its point, not on the flat part. That represents the number of people who can pull the work off at any given age. And down at the bottom, there aren't a whole lot of us. I was one of them. I could boogie. I could do a lot of different things. I had range, and I also was in the right place at the right time. So I was killing it. And then when you get into the middle, there's a fair number of roles for people. And if you superimpose these two, it's a Jewish star. And if you look at the hexagon that's in the middle of that, that's where the meat of all the work is. And that's between, say, 30 and 55. Okay, that's where all the work is. For men, anyway. But once you get up into the above the top of that, and as you can see, that narrows significantly no matter which group you're looking at. But the available number of people who can do the work has grown while the number of roles available has diminished. So there's much more competition for fewer roles. Years ago, this was one of the last things I went up on in California before I moved back here. I went to meet, they were casting for a show called 6 Feet Under, and they were going to be introducing a new character. And it was to play opposite Frances, who was the mother on the show. And it was to be her sort of boyfriend. And I can't begin to explain to you the people who were sitting in this room when I walked in. I mean, it was Stacy Keach and David Carradine and Anthony Zerbe and I'm blanking now. They're probably eight or nine other, during the time I was there, other people. I was absolutely the youngest. But it was like, you know, I said, if a bomb hit this place right now, we'd be fresh out of character actors in LA. No, it was true. It was amazing. It was one of the greatest, like, hours of my life, was just sitting there with all these guys. But most of whom I knew, some of whom I'd worked with, but then we all knew each other, right? And so I go in, I have this great meeting with them, and it's very funny. And I'm saying, so what am I? I'm like the cradle robbing choice with these guys. Everybody's like 10 years or more old, and they all left. And he said, yeah, we don't really know what we're going to settle on, but no, you're absolutely, this is not a joke. We absolutely wanted you here. I said, great. Well, I'd love to do it. And, you know, and I don't even remember if we read or if we just chatted. Anyway, as I'm leaving and I'm walking to my car, car comes by, stops, and the window rolls down, and he says, hey, Richard, and it's James Cromwell. And James and I were on the Hotel Baltimore together, which was the first series I did and the first series he did. It was the first thing he did on television, and me too. And the minute I saw him, I went, that's the guy. Because by then he was like, he had already done Babe, he'd done a whole bunch of stuff. He was huge. I mean, and doing great work everywhere. And it was a part that was just really tailor-made for him. And if he were willing to come in and do it, it was clear they were going to cast him. And in fact, they did. But why did I start telling you this? Oh, it was kind of, that's the narrowing of the triangle. See, we're all there for this one role. Only one of us was walking out of there with a part. Now, that's always the case. But to put this quantity of experience and talent and accomplishment in one room to talk about what is a very supporting role in an already ongoing series at a time when this was not common to do something like this, to add a new character where you were going to bring in as it turns out, a movie star to play it on a cable, you know, premium cable show. That was pretty much unheard of at the moment. So it was, you know, that all of that. And now, you know, just to wrap this hugely long answer up, now the fact of the matter is, look, I have three pensions. I'm very, very lucky. I think I mentioned this before. Two of them are little. One of them is nice and solid. If it weren't for those, I'd really be scraping by in terms of, even with as much work as I've been doing on these shows on Netflix and Amazon and TV Land and stuff like that, even on CBS, frankly, doing guest stuff, I wouldn't be able to really maintain my life the way the pensions make that possible. And I'm working as much, if not more, than most of the people I know. Of the group of us who were gathered for this, with the exception of my friend Len Carew, I would guesstimate that I'm working as much as anybody in this group. And it would not be easy for me if I didn't have pensions. So, and that's a new reality. You know, back in the three network, you know, like I said, eight guest shots a year, plus the very nice residuals you get off the guest shots, you could put a living together. It's much harder now. So like I said, I think we're very lucky to have lived through that time and to have worked through that time. And those of us who actually participated in that in a way that was fruitful, we're incredibly lucky, because I don't know that we're going to ever see those days again. People will make very good money in this business, a small group of people will, but they won't have the kind of consistency, in my opinion, that we had, where you could, you have to get into a position of just nailing it one job after another in order to make it work now. And I could work 3 months in the year and I was good, especially when I started doing movies. If I put together 3 months of actual work during the year, that was a good year for me, because I was being paid very decent money, because that went along with it, because you had quotes that followed you, and they, so many of the features that get made now are being made on these little tiny budgets. Nobody's making money. If something really hits hugely, then maybe you're going to see some more money out of it. But remember, there's this really small band of films that are being made at the huge budgets where they're paying really, really substantial salaries, and where they, but most of the salaries they're paying substantial salary, I mean, most of the people they're paying substantial salaries to are these two or three people at the top, and everybody else is getting as little as they can possibly pay you, regardless of what you ever got paid before, and you feel lucky to have the work. So, and it's one of the things, you know, when we talk about the union, it's where I'm going after this, is I'm going to a meeting of a wages and working conditions committee, which I'm so over. I don't need to be doing this anymore, but so I got asked to go, and I'm going because I feel a sense of responsibility. And one of the things we've talked about in the union is the way things are going, we may have to just jettison everything else we're interested in and just say, we need to vastly increase the price of a day's work for a regular person, even though we make what is arguably an obscene amount of money if you're working on a film, a day's work right now is, what is this, $800 or something. Nobody makes $800. I mean, well, some people do. But the thing is that very few of us work more than a handful of days every year. So in order to try and since we also now have, you know, we have a qualifying amount for health care, which is $17,000 a year. When I came in, health care was $3,500 a year. And that also got you a pension credit. Now, a pension credit is $22,000. healthcare is 17,000. And again, that means at $800 a day, you got to put a bunch of days together in order to make that. And that's hard to do. It's really hard to do that, which is why people, there are no longer, I don't think, or hardly ever, hardly any specialists anymore who just do. When I was first doing this, we wouldn't have thought of doing a commercial. We wouldn't have thought of doing, a lot of people who did features, they would not do television. It was considered a shameful thing to work on TV when I first came in. Then as I was there, that broke down. People were moving back and forth between TV and film, but it was looked down upon. It's no longer looked down upon at all. Commercials are not looked down upon at all in LA, but in New York, but in LA they still are. In LA, I was just talking to an actress who had been, I'm not going to name her, but she had been, she'd gotten well known very young, and then she dropped out of the business for a while, and when she came back in, back into the business in New York, and commercials were available to her, and she would not do a commercial because she thought she was still quite recognizable, and she thought if people see me doing a commercial, they're going to go, oh my God, what happened to her? Whereas if I do a little indie film, or even if I do some guest shots, nobody's going to say that. And so she cut off that avenue of earnings for potential earnings. Nobody can do that anymore. Nobody. I mean, I'm sure some people do, but you can't. You're ill-advised to do that anymore, I think. Anyway.
Okay. Thank you.